Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The struggle to pay for higher education is a common refrain these days, with price tags at some schools rivaling many families' average incomes. Another well-known story concerns New Hampshire students in particular, carrying among the nation's highest debt levels upon graduation. But our guests today say college financing doesn't have to mean a lifetime of loan payback. However, it does mean students and their families need to put in some early legwork in figuring out the system, which, to the average person, can appear a confusing, random patchwork of loans, grants, scholarships, and other complicated mechanisms. So today in The Exchange, it's Higher Education Financing 101. And let's get your questions in. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests for the hour. Bill Hewen is here, District Director of School Counseling for the Hudson School District. Bill, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
Also from D.C., Kimberly Jones, Vice President for Public Policy and Communications for the Council for Opportunity and Education. And Kimberly Jones, welcome to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Tori Berube, Vice President of College Planning and Community Engagement for the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation, known widely as the NEAF Network Organizations. And Tori, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Well, all of you, and Tori, I want to start with you. Before we jump into all the details, and there'll be a lot of detail this morning, I want to ask you about the narrative that we constantly hear of how expensive college is. Tori, to you first, but everybody, what's the impact on young people and their families when they hear that message sort of time and time and time again?
It's a great question, especially at this time of year as families are sitting down and filing with their seniors that free application for federal student aid and starting to think about a plan. And one of the things that we do at the NEAF Network Organizations is really counsel families on creating a plan that will work next year for 4 years and 4 years and 6 months from now when they graduate from college, so that families have a clear expectation about how much money they will spend over the course of the next 4 years and as that student enters repayment. Anecdotally, I was at a meeting last night where someone was mentioning the impact of student loan debt on buying a home, first-time home buyers, credit qualifying for a car. So the impact of how families think about approaching paying for college and the debt load that students will take on has longstanding ramifications.
Well, and what are those ramifications, Tori? I mean, you mentioned the financial ramifications down the road. I'm wondering if this constant narrative, especially here in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. with our debt loads as they are, is it discouraging? Do you hear people say, you know, I'm not even going to bother. I can't afford it.
I think families are really getting smart about, we know that college education and post-secondary education is important. We just want to do it smartly and really informed. So we sit with families and sort of walk them through, there's a path to college for everybody, and what's that path that makes sense for your family? So we see a lot of families coming in and sitting with us and talking to us about, perhaps we are starting at a community college and transferring to a four-year institution. Perhaps we're looking at a college that's closer to home, further from home, and really exploring all of those options when it comes to not only the fit and match academic and socially, but the fit and match for our family financially.
What about that, Kimberly? How does that narrative shape the way people look at whether they can even bother going to school?
Well, I'm glad you asked me, Laura, because I was going to say, well, certainly in New Hampshire, and I'm from Connecticut originally. I live in D.C. now, but I was born and raised in Connecticut. And so if you want to kind of say the 13 original colonies, where college going is part of the culture, I think what was said is very true, that families because it's just part of the understanding. But that's not true of the country as a whole. And especially my organization, Council for Opportunity in Education, we focus on students who are at the lower end of the economic ladder, who would be the potential first in their families to go to college. And for those students in particular, the narrative around college cost has become so overwhelming that for so many students across the country, in New England and other places, they are so turned off because they feel like college equates to debt. And so one thing our organization and our programs that we work with, one thing we do is counter that by saying, no, there are programs available, federal financial aid, state financial aid, and help the students work through that. Because unfortunately, the idea around student debt has become so overwhelming that it's turned off a lot of students to the idea especially, again, if you're coming from a low-income family, when you're given the option between going to work right away, even though we know a college graduate will make $1 million more over their lifetime. So trying to get the message out there that, no, there are ways you can afford to go to college, whether it is, as my co-panelist stated, starting at the community college, looking at federal and state grant and aid programs. So there is some work to be done in terms of combating that narrative.
Wow. So you agree with Tori, you know, that message needs to be there is a path to higher education for everyone if they want. But it seems like you're working against that narrative all the time and trying to convince families that, no, you really can do this. I wonder you, Bill Hewen, how about the teens and parents you work with? How do they sort of interpret this pretty negative message that we hear about paying for college?
Sure. It's a very sensitive topic when you're working with families and discussing finances. To a lot of people, it's a very private matter. So it's unique, and one of the many roles school counselors have is working with students and families to discuss that and to kind of work around the paralysis they have in looking at their future and worrying so much about things. So it's definitely school counseling at its finest. When we're looking at the process of going through looking at colleges, and there's a lot of different ways, and Tori touched on a lot of them, which is great. But it's also just explaining to them exactly that, you know, apply to the schools, apply to every possible financial aid options, scholarship options, and talk to the schools. The schools, especially the private schools, the non-publics, do have a pool of money and they do the best they can to kind of help meet that gap. So I think it's a lot of perception we have to work through that they're going to be burdened for life. And the reality is there's going to be some kind of debt they're going to incur with higher education, but it's not going to smother them for their entire life. And they have to kind of just kind of go through the process to understand it and to trust in the fact that, you know, there is a pathway. And looking at any college, you're looking at, you know, the schools you really want to go to and can I get in? And there's that whole like the reach schools versus the I can get in schools. And we kind of have to look at that way financially, too.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, going back to when I applied to college, you more thought about it that way. Can I get in the reach school, the pretty sure I'll get in school and I'll be happy. And I'm not that excited, but, you know, maybe for my first year, it's OK. So now you're saying you need to apply that same standard, Bill, to whether you can afford it or not.
I think absolutely. I think there's families have a certain pool of money that they can commit to higher education. And you want to make sure that you're not just settling. I think Tori mentioned the word fit. Their school has a fit for somebody regarding, you know, where they're at, the major they have, the size of the school, et cetera. And I think you don't want to lose that because you're afraid of incurring the cost. And there's many ways, once again, through the great services NEEF has in other states and through financial aid and scholarships to kind of make it doable. It's not going to be free. I think that's, you know, it's a nice idea, but they're going to have to work and there's going to be some tough choices that have to be made.
Go ahead, Tori.
Well, and one of the things that's important to remember here in New Hampshire is that about 75% of the graduates from our four-year institutions will graduate with debt. So having a clear understanding of what that debt might look like and how your family wants to incur it is really important. It will be debt. But again, to Kimberly's point, college graduates we know make more over a lifetime, are more engaged civically, all of those things, better health, all those things that we kind of talk about socially, but working with families and helping them really create a plan We always work with families, and Bill mentioned having them apply to a variety of schools. One of our pieces that we put together is always having a financial safety school on that list of schools.
Not just an academic safety school, but
right.
a financial safety
so,
school.
So, and a financial safety school for some might be a state public institution here in New Hampshire. For some families, it might be starting at a community college and transferring on. Everybody has, you know, a different reality as to what's appropriate for their family.
Well, and when you talk about debt, and we'll definitely talk about, you know, the different types of debt and so forth, but you seem to be saying, Tori, that, you know, yeah, you're going to take on some debt, but it doesn't have to be astronomical. And keep in mind, as a college grad, you will have the ability to pay off that debt. You know, we got a lot of contact from our listeners before the show, and I want to remind people that you can join us now as well with your questions and comments. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Today in Exchange, we are looking once again at paying for college. We'd love to get your questions and comments in. Again, our email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can call us at 1-800-892-6477. You can also respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. And SM on Twitter contacted us. SM says, why is college so expensive that a person has to take on titanic levels of loans or beggar their parents? When will we see affordable higher education and trade school pathways in this country? The Gen X crowd, SM says, will never know the prosperity and financial security of previous generations. And, you know, there's so much in there, Kimberly. There's a sense of frustration from this person, SM. It's almost like people feel like they've been cheated.
There is definitely a question on, well, why does college cost so much? And Congress is investigating that question all the time. I mean, there's some factors that are specific to different types of institutions in terms of maintaining the facilities, in terms of competing for the best and brightest as far as students, professors, coaches, et cetera. But one thing that Congress is doing, you've got to remember there's two major parties and there's two chambers. So they're each controlled by a different party now. And so there's going to be different approaches. But I think as we move forward through the next 2 years of this 116th session of Congress, there are going to be attempts by Congress to address the rise in college costs, whether or not they'll be able to put laws into place that address it during the next 2 years. It'll be a high burden to meet, but they're certainly going to attempt to. But that's something that's most definitely weighing very heavily on their minds. During the last session of Congress, the 115th, there were bills put forward in the House under the Republican rule. It didn't so much get at cost as much as it did try to deal with the students and helping students or helping, it depends on who you ask, but getting putting some of the burden on students in terms of limiting how much debt they would take on. I think with a democratically controlled House, you're probably going to see more measures looking at the institutions and how much they are attributing to students or allowing students to take on debt.
That's interesting. So Congress is kind of putting the onus sometimes on the schools, Kimberly. Don't let these students graduate with crushing amounts of debt. That's interesting.
I think you're going to see in a Democratic House, there's going to be a little bit more onus on the institutions, whereas in a Republican-controlled chamber, you're going to see more onus on the students. But whatever pathway, because, again, it's a divided government right now, they're going to have to, in order to get anything done, there's going to have to be sort of a meeting of the minds in the middle.
Well, speaking of a meeting of the minds in the middle, we are in the midst of a government shutdown. And, Tori, I did wonder if you've noticed the effects of the shutdown so far on just helping New Hampshire students process all these, you know, loans and financial aid forms, some of which are federally processed or overseen.
Well, so filing FAFSA, we're in the middle of the free application for federal student aid season with high school seniors and returning college students, right? So that the FAFSA form that many folks know we talk about a lot here is that application that gets students into the financial aid pipeline for federal aid and institutional aid. And there are no issues with filing the FAFSA today as a result of the shutdown.
Are there at DOE looking at these
working
applications?
They're working, and FAFSAs are processed, and we're able to link information on filing FAFSAs with families to the IRS data retrieval tool, which has been something that's been in place, and those systems are still a go. They're working just fine today. Where we see some flexibility that has happened because of the federal shutdown is some students are selected for something called verification. And usually these are the low income first gen, might have something a little out of the norm on their FAFSA, and they're selected to provide additional information to financial aid offices. And they used to have to, prior to the shutdown, request something called an IRS tax transcript. That process has been impacted by the federal shutdown. However, the U.S. Department of Ed has provided some guidance that now allows financial aid offices to accept signed tax returns. And that has been the workaround. So day-to-day impact of families applying for federal financial aid has not been impacted by the federal shutdown.
Okay. Well, let's go to our listeners. More questions. SM, thank you for that. Oh, Kimberly, did you want to jump in too?
I did just want to add one thing to Tori's comment. Because some families do not file tax returns, they are selected for verification. The Department of Education has also said if your family does not file, then you can also provide a statement stating that
yes,
you do not file. So that also will help the students proceed with their financial aid application.
Okay, great to know. Because, again, I was wondering, I know a lot of this stuff is all federally processed, so I was wondering how it might be affected by the shutdown. Thank you, SM, for that tweet. And let's go to the phones. Vicky's calling from New Boston. Hi, Vicky. You're on the air. Welcome.
Just an experience thing that we have just encountered. Our son just transferred his freshman year. He applied to several schools, and he got into all of them and got great merit scholarships to all of them. And we sat down with all the NEES stuff that we got, and it was really, really super helpful. We went to all the seminars, and we let him make the final decision out of the ones that we thought that were doable financially. And it turned out that the school he chose, he was absolutely miserable at. And he really, really was upset, and he wanted to transfer. And so we said, okay, we'll be supportive and we'll transfer you. And lo and behold, we find out, I guess common sense to some people, but not to us. We did not realize that all merit scholarships are pulled off the table 100%.
So, oh, my goodness. When you switch schools, Vicki?
Yep. When you switch schools, even if it's in the freshman year, and we were really, like, taken aback, and it was like a big shock that even other schools that he hadn't applied to, we started looking into them and said, hey, you know, he's a freshman. Could we apply for a transfer? Do you offer merit scholarships?
Yeah.
And
I think I get your point, Vicky. Yeah. I think I get your point. And Bill, I'll turn to you. It is, you know, great. You got a merit scholarship. Oh, you switched schools. So is the merit scholarship attached to that particular school?
Yeah, it's interesting and a kind of related topic, too. And as you go in from your senior year into your freshman year of college, there's a lot more scholarship opportunities for the student in their first year of school coming from either local scholarships or just first year that tend to go away as they go into their second year of college.
Oh, interesting. Okay, just because you got it for the first year doesn't mean you get it for the second year.
Correct.
But is merit scholarship money, Tori, attached to a particular school? I only get it if I go to school X, not school Y?
Correct. Merit money is coming from the school.
Yeah.
And so in Vicky's case, that offer was probably extended to her son last spring when he got his financial aid award letters. When he declined to attend those schools that offered that merit money was pulled off the table because he's not a new student, he's a transfer student.
All right, well, it is confusing, Vicky, so I completely understand, and we'll try to untangle the financial aid system a little bit more after a short break. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange. Join me and a panel of experts in Nashua for a conversation on New Hampshire's opioid crisis. As part of NHPR's Crossroad Reporting Project, we take stock of where the state is now with this epidemic and what the future might be. Join us at the Nashua Public Library on February 7th at 6:30 p.m. Get your free tickets at nhpr.org/events.
This event is sponsored in part by Dartmouth Hitchcock.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, paying for college 101. Given the huge sums at stake, the idea of financing higher ed can be intimidating, but there is help in figuring out how to pay for it all. Although, as our guests say, it does require some advanced thought and lots of planning. Let's get your questions in. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests for the hour. Kimberly Jones joins us from D.C. She's Vice President for Public Policy and Communications for the Council for Opportunity in Education. Bill Hewen is here in studio, District Director of School Counseling for the Hudson School District, along with Tori Berube, Vice President of College Planning and Community Engagement at the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation. And all of you, before we go back to our listeners, I did want to turn to, well, you, Kimberly, to start off, but everybody. You know, the schools in large letters will say, and I've been through this process with one kid, we offer lots of financial aid. That's the capital letter sentence. But then in smaller letters, it seems to say, Kimberly, to all eligible students. How do they decide, Kimberly or anybody, but Kimberly, you first, who's eligible and who isn't? Because to the families, it can seem sort of random.
Well, for the students that we represent, the Council for Opportunity in Education, we work with students who are low-income first-generation students who are served by the federal TRIO program. And so our student population is the most needy. They come from families who earn in excess of 150% of poverty. So by whatever measuring stick a college will use, these young people come with great financial need. But by and large, outside of the federal guidelines, which you know, our standard across the board, every institution will have its own set of measuring sticks, per se, in terms of what they look for. There are some schools that are completely need-based because they're at such a high caliber in terms of their applicants that every single student would qualify if you selected based on merit. And other schools, they're really competing for the best talent, so they'll throw a merit scholarship on the table to try to lure one student away from another institution. So it really varies from place to place.
What do you think, Tori?
She's exactly right. And other criteria that may make students eligible for institutional aid may be you're enrolled full-time, you're enrolled part-time, you're a New Hampshire resident, you're, a, you know, redheaded and left-hand, you know, red-haired and left-handed. So each institution will have their own criteria for what they deem as eligible.
It seems so random, really. I mean, and being in that era somewhat myself, you know, parents will get around and they'll start to talk and some parents will say, wow, we got, you know, X thousand dollars to help. And other parents will say, really, we got nothing. And, you know, it does seem kind of like you said, each school has its kind of secret code mm-hmm. for who's eligible and who isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair? I mean, if you're really low income, then, you know, the students that Kimberly works with, absolutely. But in a general group of like middle class, middle income people, some people get so much and some people get so little.
It's a really great question.
Yeah, it doesn't seem as like a lot of transparency, Bill.
Well, I kind of look back at a book I read years ago called The Gatekeepers, and I think there's a behind-the-scenes part that colleges have looking at trying to maximize their diversity on campus. So if there's all things being equal or close to equal and there's a pool of money, the school may decide that I want that red-headed, left-handed oboe player so that financial aid, that merit scholarship may go to that person because they want to have a more diverse campus. So they'll divvy that out based on what their overall goals are. Once again, I don't think they're trying to hurt necessarily the students that kind of need, because I think everybody who's going to college needs some assistance. But I think that fairness piece, I think, is more of a behind-the-scenes admissions financial aid process, which is something that I don't think is very transparent just by the nature of the confidentiality of the acceptance process.
Sure. And when you read the literature, again, they often trumpet, you know, we give lots of financial aid and most students who go to this school get, you know, financial aid. But then in the small print, it's those we deem needy and some people are deemed more needy than others, regardless of their income sometimes.
One of the things that the federal government required colleges to implement about, 8 years ago, is something called a net price calculator. And every college has one, and it's a great way for families to start to understand what type of typical aid packages a school will offer based on a certain set of criteria. So you input data about your family's finances, your students' grades for merit money, their SAT or ACT scores, and then the school mirrors that with what a typical aid package might look like for your student. And that's a great tool that families can use really any time, junior or senior year, to get a sense of what does a typical aid package look like, because there are so many variables that go into it.
Sure, school by school by school. Back to our listeners, all of you. And Tom sent us an email. Would your guests care to comment on how financial literacy plays into educational decisions? Tom says, today we ask our kids to make a financial decision at age 17 or 18, equivalent to the purchase of our first home. Tom says our kids are often ill-informed and equipped to make such a significant financial decision that can burden them for a lifetime. Tom, thank you so much for the point. And Kimberly, what do you think?
Well, financial literacy is a huge component, not just for the individual students, but for families. Again, the TRIO programs, we work with students and families to provide that financial literacy component. It's a requirement. We're a federal program, and it's embedded in our law that this is something that we do to help the students and families understand the holistic picture of what they're getting into, so to speak. And I think across the board, we're starting to see more stories of that happening, high schools in different parts of the country where they're instituting a financial literacy program, where they're having an adulting day, because you're just not getting those basic skills, whether it's how to balance a checkbook, to how to how the loans and credit cards work. So we are seeing more of that, and I hope we'll continue to see more of that across the board, because I had no idea, when I was applying to college, and even when I told my parents I wanted to go on to graduate school, they said, well, you have to pay for it. I had no concept of what that meant, and I'm still paying for those graduate school education today.
Wow, so. Okay. So you feel this personally. What do you think, Tori? You want to jump in?
One of the services that we provide at NEEF that I think families find most helpful is that we sit with them and help them understand their financial aid award letters. And as part of that, we talk with students about what the debt load will look like when they're starting to repay that debt. And we talk with them in terms of what career path they're thinking. So we'll use a variety of tools to say, here's a starting salary for that career, and here's what your student loan debt looks like. And let's talk about that. So let's talk about not only will you have student loan debt to repay, but you're going to have to live somewhere. You're going to have a car or public transportation, and you're going to have some clothes, and you're going to have food. And so let's talk about what that might look like. And sometimes when you sit with students and they say, wow, on a monthly basis, I'm going to make $1,800 and my student loan payment is $1,000 a month.
Doesn't leave a lot left over.
That doesn't leave a lot to eat and to live. And so what are my other options? So financial literacy and financial capability education, very important. But one of those services that we bring is linking career to student loan debt and possible income and expense.
Well, and when you talk about looking ahead to what you mentioned, Tori, and I'm looking at you, Bill, career, loans, other expenses, are young people being encouraged, nudged into higher paying careers, even if they may want to be, a school teacher or an artist or something? I mean, is this specter of having to pay for college nudging kids into careers that maybe they're not as interested in, but gee, computer science is high paying, so I'll do it?
That's a great point. I think, once again, working with students and their families, we want to make sure that it's about fit. It's a difficult conversation when we have with a student that they want to go to school for what they're passionate about, what they love to do, regardless of the cost. However, we can't ignore the fact that there's a certain return on investment. I remember a couple of years ago, there was an article I read that the best return on investment was a petroleum engineering degree out of Oklahoma, because immediately out of school, you're looking at six figures, as opposed to a social work degree in Mississippi, where you're paying a lot and the income you're going to get right out of school is not equivalent to the other one. So are we encouraging people to go to college for jobs that pay well? I don't, as a school counselor, I don't think in those terms. I think about the student's strengths, their interests, their passion, and it's maybe it's pie in the sky and naive, but I want them to be happy in the career that they're going into. Will the money come? I'd like to think so. I can't guarantee that, but I don't want someone to have a passion to be a chef and do culinary, but then switch and want to be a nurse because there's jobs out there and it pays well, when their true passion is something totally different.
Well, and New Hampshire desperately needs social workers for the child welfare system, for example. We talked about that yesterday. There's a huge shortage of mental health professionals, substance abuse professionals, careers that don't pay a ton but are desperately needed, and you can really make an important difference in somebody's life. So
absolutely,
there's that end of it too. Go ahead, Tori.
One of the things that I think we find most challenging and most disconcerting is for students who pick a major and an intended career path because they think that's where the money is, and they don't complete their education, right? So they start and they think, I'm going into engineering, petroleum engineering, and they realize, wow, that's a lot of science and math, and that's not me.
I'd rather study American history.
Right. And they leave school, and for whatever circumstance, they don't go back because now they've started college, they've incurred debt, and they're not back in school completing that degree. So they're trying to pay off those student loans and that debt that they've incurred, and they have not, they don't have the means to do so.
So Tori, in that, I think it was the net price calculator you were talking about, having students look at their debt and look at their potential careers, are you concerned that that does kind of nudge people into those higher paying careers without intending to do so?
No, because in some cases, perhaps, but I think with what Bill referenced is that we really talk with students about picking something and pursuing something that's going to make you happy and understanding.
You got to get out of bed every morning.
Right. So. You got to get out of bed every morning for the next 40 years of your life. But doing it responsibly and doing it informed is so key as part of this process.
Let's go back to our listeners, and I'm going to throw this next question at you, Kimberly. Matt on Twitter says, college is a big investment. As an 18-year-old, I wasn't sure what I wanted to study or what career to pursue. For students and families who may be feeling the same anxiety, I would recommend doing a full-time service year where you can build skills, travel, earn a living, stipend, and education award for college. Service year programs like AmeriCorps, Vista, City Year give young people an opportunity to make a difference, work with people from different backgrounds and all walks of life, and build their resumes. As a two-term AmeriCorps alumnus, I couldn't recommend more highly a service year as a productive gap year experience. Matt, thank you so much for bringing that to the table. And I wonder what you think about that, Kimberly.
You know, well, first of all, congratulations to Matt. It sounds like it was a wonderful experience for him. But to quote a recent episode of the show Black-ish, you are not Malia Obama. And not everybody, I think, has the, for lack of a better word, luxury of doing a gap year. I think for some students, it's absolutely a wonderful experience and provides the time to really explore, to really get firm about what you want to do with your life. For many other students, I think it has the potential to really derail them from getting back on an academic pathway. And I hate to speak in broad strokes, but I'm thinking mostly of the students that my organization works with, the low-income first gen, where if there's already a pull away from higher education, we don't want to further that by saying, oh, you know, go do a gap year. Because honestly, what would typically happen is they will start working, start making money that their family will then begin to count on, and then be further driven from pursuing higher education. And so I support AmeriCorps and experiential learning opportunities, but it's not necessarily for everyone. I think it's just something that shouldn't be entered into lightly. It sounds like this young man had the family infrastructure and support to really make that happen. And I know young people who, when I was college age, who did that because they just felt they were burnt out after high school. If you're a student who's a little bit more ambivalent and not sure, and don't have the necessarily the familial support and the financial support, I don't know if that's necessarily the right pathway. But it certainly is an option for some, but not for all.
Got a question, too, from a listener before the show, Carrie, who wants to ask about scholarships, and also a question from Matt, who wants to ask about AmeriCorps. So let me go to Matt first. Do New Hampshire colleges let students defer admission to serve with AmeriCorps? Do colleges offer credit and or tuition breaks to service year alumni? Do you know, Tori?
Can they defer for a year, for a gap year? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the second part of that question, Laura, was?
They offer credit and or tuition breaks to service year alumni?
That, I think, would be more of an institutional
school
decision.
By school.
Yeah.
And then a question from Carrie, who says, we move from Florida. Does New Hampshire offer similar scholarships to the Bright Futures for students with higher GPAs and aptitudes? Bill, do you know about that? Are there special scholarships here in New Hampshire for students who are at the tops of their class?
Once again, I think, and we start talking about colleges and schools, the famous words that all school counselors work on is "it depends." I think
so frustrating.
It is,
because you want a clear answer.
And I think to some degree there is, if you know where to ask. I think in New Hampshire, I'm not 100% sure if there's a specific title about Bright Futures, but I know there's a ton of scholarship opportunities with ranges from either talent or GPA. A lot of the merit-based higher GPA-type scholarships, I think, come directly from the schools. You mentioned earlier with the merit-based. I think there's schools that give out scholarships based on what percentile you graduate in. Your SAT scores is an interesting topic. On a side note, a lot of schools are test-optional regarding College Board ACT or SATs, but then they'll use those scores for merit-based scholarships. So how do you deal with that? So that's a separate issue. I don't want to get off on a tangent. But I think no matter what state you come from, it's all like politics. It's all local. You have to look at what scholarships are available in your community within the state. NEEF is a great database. New Hampshire Charitable Foundation is also a very good corporation that helps students find scholarship money. So I think it's a matter of doing your research, knowing where to go to ask questions, and keep asking. If you hit a wall, don't stop.
So merit-based aid, just to make sure I'm crystal clear, Tori, merit-based aid is based on your academic or perceived academic abilities.
Or sports talent or
whatever
musical,
you bring to the table.
Artistic, yep.
It's that random factor that we talked
You've
about before.
Reached some achievement in
something.
Some discipline, whether it be academics, whether it be the arts, whether it be playing at a D1 school, D1 or D2, playing sports. Yep.
So that's merit. And then need-based is solely based on the numbers.
Correct.
You're crunching the numbers. And we, the federal government, based on this FAFSA form,
free application for federal student aid.
That's based on the numbers of your family income. And,
correct.
You know, it's
that
their
is
assessment.
Strictly, the driving force behind that is really what's on your parent or parents' tax return, as well as your own as a student.
Okay. And what's the biggest complaint you hear about FAFSA, Tori? Or complaints? Probably a lot of them.
So I've been doing this work now for 10 years, and the FAFSA form, people still groan when you say the word FAFSA.
Yeah.
It is 100 million times better and easier to navigate than it was 10 years ago. However, it is still, for most families, a 40 to 45 minute process with data that is really accessible in other places, you know, from taking it from a tax return. It's time consuming, and there's myths that if a parent provides their information on a FAFSA, that they are required to help pay for college. That's not true.
Okay.
Simplifying the FAFSA, tying it to use of existing data would be great, especially for the populations that Kimberly mentioned.
So Kimberly, yeah, I will talk to you about that, Kimberly, after a short break, because we know that there are efforts. I think you touched on that before. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, how Granite Staters heat their homes in the winter and how that's changing. Send us an email. How do you keep your home warm? What's great about it? What's not so great? We want your home heating questions and conundrums. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Now, this hour, we are looking at the fundamentals of paying for college. And you can join us now with your questions and comments. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And to all of you, before we go back to our listeners, Kimberly, just touch on this again, if you could, please. Some of the efforts in Congress to make this big, hairy FAFSA form that we keep talking about a little bit easier.
Oh, sure. So that's probably one of the few areas of agreement across the board where members from both sides of the aisle, from both chambers of Congress, think that there needs to be change. Actually, at the end of the last Congress in the Senate, a bill was passed called the FAFSA Act that actually would have done just what Tori talked about, making it easier to retrieve data from the IRS into the FAFSA. It was done at the very end of the term, so it didn't get a chance to move through the entire Congress. But I believe it's going to be reintroduced shortly for this session of Congress. And if nothing else, there's as we discussed earlier, there's a desire to do a full-scale reauthorization of higher education. But even if that doesn't move forward, there's definitely a huge burning desire by the chairman, Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, in the Senate, and by members across the board to simplify the FAFSA, because everyone agrees it's a behemoth that puzzles even the accountants and PhDs among us. One positive measure we've seen moving forward is that the Department of Ed has moved to an app. So I think that's going to see some hopeful improvement. But yeah, we definitely need to move forward, and Congress is eager to do that.
Well, and Kimberly, you mentioned that, again, you work with low-income families, first-generation college students. They still have to fill out the FAFSA too, though, right?
Oh, absolutely.
To show their financial need.
Yes.
How does looking at that, first of all, you talked earlier about how you have to convince these families that, yes, your child can go. Yes, we'll help you figure out how to pay for it. But how do they approach this, sort of ginormous form? Maybe in some families, the parents don't speak English as the first language. Maybe some of the young people you work with are on their own. How does this form kind of, deter them from the path of higher ed?
Well, absolutely. Just all the things you mentioned, as well as what Tori mentioned earlier, some families are under the impression that because they fill out the form, that means they must contribute. But very often your contribution is zero because there's so little money coming into the household. And so that's part of what the counselors in our programs do, is help work with the students and the families to help them navigate it, because it's scary. I mean, it was scary for me, and I had two college-educated parents who were able to help pay for my college, but it's such a monster. And so by walking the students and families through it, we're able to kind of dispel some of those concerns. But it is quite challenging for anybody, so let alone, again, if you're going to be the first one, no one's done it before. And a lot of times you also have systems where families are afraid. They do not trust the government. They don't want to give the government their information. And so you've got quite a few barriers.
Interesting.
For getting people to fill things out.
Well, and I know NEEF helps people with this FAFSA for sure. And Kimberly, I think an organization you're involved with, the TRIO program, works again with low-income families. You guys are holding some workshops coming up in February, just walking people through it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Well,
Kimberly?
Not just workshops, but actually the end of February is actually going to be our National TRIO Day celebration. Back in 1986, Congress declared the last Saturday in February as National TRIO Day to honor the impact of first-generation low-income students, and our communities just kept that alive since then. And I believe the New England community is going to celebrate in New Hampshire on the last Saturday of this month, which is the 23rd.
Okay, and I encourage everybody to check out our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Lots of resources there that our producer, Ellen Grimm, put up. Go ahead, Tori. Do you want to jump in?
So here in the state of New Hampshire, we're fortunate, and we have two TRIO programs. One's based at UNH. One's based at Keene State.
And what does that stand for again?
Kimberly, help me out with the acronym for
TRIO. Here's the great joke. TRIO is not an acronym.
Oh.
Initially, when they originally created the programs in the Higher Education Act, there were three of them. It was a TRIO of programs.
Gotcha.
Then
okay.
Then it's grown, but the name stuck.
Go ahead, Tori.
I learned something. That's cool. So in New Hampshire, that TRIO Day and FAFSA filing will be celebrated on those campuses. But they're working with schools like Farmington Central, Spalding, Manchester Memorial, Summersworth, Manchester West, Fall Mountain Regional, Hinsdale, and Keene. And then there's also a program that's run out of UNH called Educational Talent Search, where they work with 19 public high schools here in the state, low-income, first-gen kids like Kimberly's group, again, supporting them with FAFSA filing, career exploration, academic preparation. So those national programs are here in the state, and across, northeast, south, and west, working in high schools every day with low-income, first-gen kids.
Well, and it's interesting, too, as we talked about, as you said earlier, right at the beginning of the show, Tori, there is a path to college for everyone. You told me before we started that one of your colleagues is at the Sununu Center today. That's the youth juvenile justice center.
Yep.
So
one of our counselors is sitting at the Sununu Center today, working with students who are currently at that center and making a plan for what they will do when they leave. So she sits with them and talks with them about college career planning, guiding them to the FAFSA and what next steps might be appropriate for them.
Okay.
And that's, again, another population that we work with and all of these federal programs work with.
Here's an email that just came in from Patrick. And I'm going to throw this at you, Bill. Patrick says, college tuition in Canada is $5,000 a year. Why and why not in the U.S.? Could that ever happen? I have to tell you, I know a bunch of kids who are going to school in Canada and the U.K., English-speaking countries, great schools, half the price of the United States.
Absolutely. I don't want to get into funding issues with politics and taxes and that whole socialistic point of view. I don't want to talk politics, but I totally agree with you that there's been a huge push, especially being in New Hampshire, being on the border of Canada. We've had more and more colleges from Canada come visit us.
Yeah, they're recruiting. The colleges from the UK, too. They recruit heavily in New England.
There's Canadian college fairs. They come down. And the big push, and rightly so, they're touting the fact that the cost of education in Canada is less than what it would be in the United States. I had talked to a parent about that, and they were concerned. And I said, well, if you drive from Hudson, New Hampshire, 3 hours north, you're in Canada going to a school that you're paying X for. If you drive 3 hours south, you're in maybe Connecticut or New York. So the distance really isn't a concern. So you have to open your mind and kind of just be willing to experiment maybe by looking at Canada or looking at the UK or looking at other countries. And I know distance is always a concern. Parents don't want their babies going away, but they're not babies anymore, and it's always a good experience to teach independence and then to recognize the cost savings and education's phenomenal too.
I mean, are we going to see a brain drain, Bill, from New Hampshire? I mean, we want these young people to come back. But, again, I know a lot of people who are going to school in the UK and in Canada, loving it. And, maybe they don't come back.
Well, I think the brain drain piece is if they go away to school for cost reasons, that's a separate issue that New Hampshire has to kind of figure out. But I think in New Hampshire, making it attractive to come back. If I'm going to go to school for engineering, I'm going to go to school for social work. You mentioned earlier about helping out. Are there going to be jobs here that are paying? And what's the economic climate in New Hampshire that's going to want me to come back and the quality of life? I think that's a bigger issue than education.
Well, and we've talked about that a lot on the show. So you're right. Did you want to jump in, Tori?
Other than to point out that sometimes there's that myth that if my student does go to an international school, will they still qualify for federal financial aid through the U.S. Department of Ed? Yes, most of those schools will take Title IV funds or funds from the federal government, and they are transportable to schools in Canada, schools in Scotland, schools in the UK, which is great. So again, filing the FAFSA.
Well, Patrick, I really appreciate the question, and it's a trend that I'm definitely seeing more and more. Let's take another call. This is Pam in Dover. Go ahead, Pam, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, good morning.
Morning.
I have a question about midlife career change. If you become, say, 40 you've worked at a job so you could pay off your student loan, and then you decide, no, I'd like to be a minister or a massage therapist or a librarian or a truck driver. Are there scholarships out there for midlife career change? And could the gentleman please repeat that database that he was talking about for scholarships? Thanks.
Okay.
I'll take the answer off the line.
Yeah, Pam, thank you so much. And this is a great question for you, Tori. And I think the database that Bill mentioned is the NEEF website, which has gargantuan amount of resources.
Right. So our website is nhheaf.org. So nhheaf.org. Numerous scholarships also follow us on social media, and we post scholarship opportunities every day because there are lots of private scholarships out there. Locally, I would direct this woman, scholarships for mid-career life-changing folks. Here in the state of New Hampshire, the single best resource to reach out to for scholarships is the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, and their website is nhcf.org.
Okay. Well, we talked about merit aid, financial aid. Kimberly, we haven't talked about Pell Grants. And I remember, you know, way back in the day when I was applying to college, a lot of people talked about Pell Grants. Do those even still exist, Kimberly? And how generous are they?
Pell Grants still exist. The challenge is that Pell Grants, unfortunately, don't have the same purchasing power as they did perhaps 15, 20, 25 years ago. And so one thing we're hoping for in the higher education community, advocacy community, is to see the growth of the Pell Grant as Congress looks to reauthorize the Higher Education Act. But they are still around.
Okay. And savings. We should talk a little bit more about savings. You know, we talked about loans and debt. But specifically, Tori, I have heard probably from your organization that it's better to get a federally backed loan than a private bank loan. We actually got a question from a listener, Kristen. What bank, et cetera, is the best option for getting a loan through? So go ahead, Tori.
So we always encourage families to maximize federal aid as much as they can before they start to explore other alternatives. And what she is referring to are private student loans, and those come from banks, credit unions,
sure,
state-based agencies, and they all have different lending criteria, different rates and fees. But if she'd like to call our office, we can provide her with a list of possible lenders to look at. Also, financial aid offices' websites will list other possible private student loan lenders to look at.
In general, though, Tori, correct me if I'm wrong, it's mm-hmm. better to get a federal student loan than one of these private loans just because of the terms of,
sure,
you know, the repayment terms and the interest rates and so
sure.
forth?
Sure. So for students, we always encourage them to take their direct student loan through the federal government, which is a result of filing the FAFSA. Every freshman is going to get $5,500 in a loan as long as they file the FAFSA. For most kids here in New Hampshire, that's not quite enough to pay the tuition bill.
Yeah, not even
so
close.
So private student loans are the next option. It's really defining what we're looking at as far as criteria, lending criteria, and repayment terms.
And of course, there's saving for college, Bill. And as soon as you have a baby, everybody says, ha, 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 congratulations on your baby. Now start saving for college. What are some of the good ways that you advise people to save for college, and how soon should they start?
For professionally and both personally speaking, I think earlier is always the best. And I really want to get something going in Hudson where when we have our kindergarten registration, I like to get a financial planner there to start talking to parents about like 529 plans.
At kindergarten registration?
Well, I think earlier is the better. I mean, if you start saving your freshman year of high school, it's way too late. And as a father of twins who are in college, I can definitely attest to that. So I think starting early in ways that are tax efficient, the 529 plans are a great way of doing that. I'm not a financial planner, I'm not sure how qualified I am to pick a specific one for a family, but look into it. Talk to your financial institutions. NEEF is also great at giving options and ideas with that. But starting as early as you can, because you don't want to have that impact your daily life. You want to be able to put money away but still be able to go on vacation, still be able to do the things you want to do without having to worry about pouring all your money into the college and have nothing else to do.
That's one of those myths that we often run into where families say, oh, I saved and I'm not going to receive any aid. Your student is still going to receive their federal financial aid. And for most families, what you've saved means you're not borrowing. And the impact of that is so important as families look at paying for college.
You know, speaking of the impacts of not being able to save, we got a sad email from Caitlin who says, I have to express how heavy the mental load of having student loans is and how much it affects your daily life. Caitlin says, virtually all of my friends have student loans of varying amounts, and it is very distressing, a huge source of shame to admit we have this much debt. It also causes us to delay getting married, purchasing property, starting families. Once we do these things, we struggle more because we are still paying our student loans in addition to paying a mortgage and paying for childcare. So that's some of the impacts of this debt that we talked about at the beginning of the show. Did you want to jump in, Bill?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's with any kind of financial planning, I think diversifying's the best way to do it. Speaking personally with my twins, we have a system where we use our savings. We use the 529, which we started when they were babies. We file the FAFSA, and they have that kind of loan process with the kids. And then there's a private loans with my wife and I take out that we're responsible for. And then schools have payment programs that we do a monthly payment for the first 4 months. And we kind of look at all the options to stay as liquid as possible as a family and not have to throw everything into college. But also we are incurring debt, and we're trying to diversify that debt so it's not all one lump sum with one person.
Well, Kimberly, last question for you. What's your just quick advice as we close out today for families maybe listening with younger kids, listening right now and thinking, oh, boy, uh-oh.
Well, I definitely echo both Bill and Tori. Start young if you can. Compound interest is your friend. Learn as much as you can. Find programs and resources that are available to you. And even if you're not starting young, for the person just wrote in about being burdened, there's a new group called the Association for Young Americans. It's basically AARP for those 35 and under. They're starting to get active around some of these issues. And so find ways to get involved and advocate for yourself because there's going to be change coming.
Okay. See, I had not even heard of that group. So thank you for bringing that to the table. And in terms of resources, I also want to remind everybody, our senior producer, Ellen Grimm, put a lot of resources on our website today. Links, information, and so forth. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And Kimberly Jones, it was really great to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Kimberly Jones. She's vice president at the Council for Opportunity and Education in D.C. Bill Hewen, good to see you. Thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Bill Hewen is district director of school counseling at the Hudson School District. And Tori Berube, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Tori Berube, she's with the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation, known as the NEAF Network Organizations. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.